Greetings, Race community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Jim Zimmerman, who serves as Chief Advancement Officer of the Branson School and consulting partner at Martz and Lundy. But most important, Jim is literally one of our earliest supporters, friends, and former teammates at Evertrue. We are long overdue in welcoming Jim to the podcast. I'm pleased to do so now. Welcome, Jim.
Good morning, Brent. It's great to see you again.
Absolutely. And while we have spent many years together, I mean, maybe just to set a little bit of context, when I was just a young boy with dreams of starting Evertrue, I had a mentor who I got to know in the Boston startup community named Walt Doyle. And Walt was an alum of the Middlesex School in Concord, Massachusetts, and then went on to do college at Emory. And when I met Walt, he said, oh, I love this idea, but you know who you've got to meet? You've got to meet Jim Zimmerman. He runs advancement at Middlesex. He knows everybody in the independent school world. And I said, great, I'd love to meet him. So I got into my wife's Dodge Stratus and I drove out to Concord. And Jim and his colleague, Maggie Patterson, were gracious enough to give me a little bit of feedback, and one thing led to another. So Jim, that's how I remember it anyways. What did I miss?
I think the piece that will always stand out for me is at the time Evertrue was really an alumni networking app. Or dreamt of being an alumni networking app, I guess. And Maggie and I saw what you were trying to do and said, we're in. And I remember vividly saying, you know, this is a great product, but it's really for my alumni director, John. And John has a budget this big and influence this big and decision-making about this big. And if you can turn this into something that can help me be a better fundraiser, my budget is this big and my decision-making power is this big. And I think that conversation sort of led to some interesting turns in the path for Evertrue. So I'll take a little bit of credit for that transition eventually.
It sure did, Jim. I will say, if I had been a fundraiser, I would have been an even better listener, and I would have listened even closer and maybe more directly moved down that path sooner, but we are where we are now. And so anyhow, just to set a little bit of context, we have known each other since the summer of 2010, in fact. And so it's great to be able to reconnect. But this is not about me or Evertrue or our work together. It's really about you. And we're excited to be able to welcome you because you've got a great perspective through your work in the independent school world, your volunteer leadership that I know was a big part of your life at Vassar College. And then also a really unique perspective, having done lots of consulting work over the years. So why don't we start, though, with just a little bit of who are you, where are you from, and take me back to junior year of high school. Who was that Jim? What was he into? And what led you to Bucknell University?
Yeah, sure. I grew up in rural Pennsylvania for the most part. Went to a big public high school. I don't remember why, but my heart was set on being a lawyer. And my path from sort of ninth grade through college was sort of the pre-law track. I had visions of going to college as far away from rural Pennsylvania as possible. And when I went to Bucknell, just sort of fell in love with the campus and the school and the people. And so ended up staying in rural Pennsylvania for college. And loved Bucknell, had a fantastic experience. And we had a January term at the time. And so I did an internship with a law firm and hated every moment I was there. Didn't like the people who liked what they were doing and liked the people who didn't really enjoy the law, and kind of went into a panic. January of my senior year, deciding that my career path was the wrong one. And there was a job opening in the annual fund at Bucknell, and a friend of mine, Bob Callan, who later became vice president at Gettysburg and Geisinger Medical Center, said, you should apply for this job. And I said, oh my God, I can't stand the student phone-a-thon. Why would I want to be in fundraising? And that summer, joined the annual fund team at Bucknell, and a few decades later, still haven't found anything else to do. So,
so tell me about month one on the job. What are you equipped with? What are the goals? What are you trying to do? Just walk me through the early days.
Yeah, Bill Torrey was the annual fund director at Bucknell. He later was the vice president for many, many years at Bowdoin. is still one of my great friends and mentors, but is a little curmudgeonly. And so that was sort of my introduction to fundraising, is a great mentor with some very strong opinions. He and I became good friends. And the annual fund at the time, this is back in 1981, was very volunteer driven, very phone-a-thon centric, lots and lots of direct mail with class agents. And so we all had our roles in. I think as the low man on the totem pole, the Syracuse Regional Phone-a-thon, the Fifth Reunion, those sorts of things. And what became sort of clear to Bill and to me, I think, was that my strengths were more in trying to get someone for their 10th reunion to give $5,000 than in broadening the participation rate or in getting class agents recruited to write their fundraising letters.
So there are a lot of people who would just shiver at the thought of having asked somebody for $5,000 for their 10th reunion. Did you take to that right away? Had you, I don't know, had other experiences in your life that made you comfortable making the ask? Because that can be something that is pretty intimidating to people, especially early in their career.
Yeah, it's a really good question, Brent. And nothing in my earlier life had prepared me for that. I was asking people for gifts more than, I think my salary that year at Bucknell was $11,000. And so I was asking people for a gift larger than my salary. It felt comfortable. It felt that by the time I got to asking somebody for that gift, there was a bit of a relationship. I knew about them. I knew what their prior giving had been. I knew what their connections to the university was. And that felt very different to me than cold calling someone for $10 or $100. And so that natural sort of relationship building, leading to feeling comfortable asking people to partner with the university and then make an investment in it, sort of felt surprisingly comfortable at a very early age.
And so at this point, right, you'd kind of move from pre-law, I want to be a lawyer, to, oh, I don't want to be a lawyer. Right. Well, this is a job. I've now got the job. And it's another thing to decide, and now I want to continue on this as a potential career path. Maybe you weren't that, intentional or, deep thoughts about it, but like going to your alma mater is different than going and joining Lawrenceville, for example. And so just tell me about how that opportunity surfaced and what inspired you to make that move.
Yeah. Back then, the way you learned about positions at other institutions was the Chronicle of Philanthropy, and everybody had an ad for their position. I had some friends who had gone to Lawrenceville, but I knew nothing of the world of independent schools. And my friend Bob Callan, who sat in the next cubicle, literally one day tossed the Chronicle of Philanthropy up over the wall between our two cubicles and had circled director of annual giving at the Lawrenceville School as a position. That sounded interesting to me. I had thought that it would feel strange going from raising money for my alma mater to raising money for Colgate or Yale or TCU. And so working at a different kind of organization felt okay. And so I applied for one position and a few months later was director of annual giving at Lawrenceville.
And then my understanding is during that role, you were able to do some frontline work as well, sort of evolve toward the major gift work. And just tell me about the early days as a road warrior.
Yeah, Lawrenceville, very national boarding school. Most of the giving, at least in those years, was from alumni. Parent giving had just begun to be part of the sort of overall fundraising. But I would bet we were 75 or 80% alumni giving. A percent of the total gifts were from alumni, particularly on the capital side. So I was traveling all the time, all over the country, a little bit of international travel, but mostly around the U.S. But Lawrenceville back in the, you know, sort of 100 years ago was a very Southern school as a Princeton sort of feeder. And we had a huge population of alumni in Natchez, Mississippi and Shreveport, Louisiana. And so spent a lot of time in the South, all on the annual fund, but over the course of that time, just made lots and lots of really strong relationships with Lawrenceville alumni. And when we chose to expand the office, we created a position of director of capital programs. That was sort of a natural fit for me, and so moved into that role. And at the same time, sort of fell in love with the notion of a boarding school and being engaged with students in sort of meaningful ways, but not too much, because I don't think I would have ever been a candidate for sort of being a teacher in a school, but being on the periphery of a school was really impactful, telling those stories as part of the fundraising message to alumni and then eventually parents in the field made me more genuine, made me more sort of a better conveyor of information from the school.
Tell me more about, like, you know, late 80s or, you know, we're in the 80s, you're going to go to Natchez, Mississippi or Shreveport, Louisiana. Walk me through the process. Like, literally, what did you do? How did you decide who was where? It might be a scary walk down memory lane to think about how all that went down, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, the every...
I assume like atlases were involved, maps perhaps, which for people listening, there used to be paper versions of maps.
Well, the best part about maps was going to AAA and getting a triptych, which would show you how to make the drive from Lawrenceville, New Jersey to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and what roads you had to take. It was, everything was paper. Everything was, every person who had ever graduated from Lawrenceville had a manila folder. Some were this big, some were this big, with all of the correspondence. That's how you did your research. You went back into the massive file room and pulled out the three files of the people you hoped you might see in Natchez, Mississippi. There was no, certainly no email. So you would make a call, usually to the person's secretary in their office, in the law office in Natchez. You would say, you know, I'm going to be in Mississippi, October 7th through the 11th, and can Mr. Jones see me? And the secretary would make an appointment, and then they did have airplanes, so I could fly to Mississippi, but he would sort of create a trip using a paper calendar and writing in 2 o'clock on Thursday for Mr. Jones and build a trip and hope that Mr. Jones was still available when you got there at 2 o'clock on Wednesday. So,
as most of our listeners know, Natchez, Mississippi is just east of Bayou Cocodri National Wildlife Reserve. And wow, no, I didn't know where Natchez was, Jim. But yeah, I mean, it's just amazing to but it worked, right? It was worthwhile. It was worth all of that manual effort to have the folders and try to keep the correspondence and do the outreach and get on the plane and hope that they're there. And I would also imagine in a lot of cases, people were excited to see you. They were excited to hear about what was going on. And especially at that time, there weren't a lot of other ways to have a conduit into an experience that had probably really changed their lives. And so, you know, I'm sure that there was, you know, for all the challenges of getting there, some pretty rewarding conversations on the other side.
Yeah, no, I think it was. I think there was a sort of a novelty of my school or my university is making some personal outreach. I don't think there was a lot of that going on. And so the more of that we did, the sort of more special the more tailor-made we could make our relationships with alums.
Well, you couldn't have moved much farther domestically from Lawrenceville to the Kate School in absolutely stunningly beautiful Santa Barbara, California. Tell me about that move and first impressions out there.
That was pure serendipity. I was approached by a headhunter about an opportunity as a development director at Kate. I was reluctant to sort of make the move. I was happy at Lawrenceville. I was as enjoying sort of my life in central New Jersey. Really didn't have any exposure to California at all, except for a few business trips, and have always loved being warm rather than being cold. Flew out to LA, drove up to Santa Barbara. It was nighttime. So went into my guest room at the head of school's house, woke up the next morning, grabbed a cup of coffee and went out to the edge of the Mesa, and the Pacific Ocean was on full display in front of me. And I thought, wow, this beats central New Jersey. And just kind of fell in love with the notion of that. Loved sort of the change in scenery, and sort of fell in love with California, and decided that was going to be a good place to be. I had in my time at Lawrenceville, I had met a gentleman named Nelson Jones, who had a son who went to Lawrenceville, was from Los Angeles. And Nelson had been sort of ironically the board chair at the Kate School, and became sort of at first the cheerleader for me to sort of join the team. And then during my time there, great, quiet, thoughtful mentor, and really sort of helped me navigate sort of that the change from East Coast philanthropy to West Coast philanthropy.
What's the difference?
West Coast philanthropy has been less mature than East Coast philanthropy. This is going back to the sort of the 90s. There was less old wealth. It was more new wealth. There was more, particularly in Southern California, more sort of asset building rather than giving away. And so for some West Coast organizations, certainly back then, philanthropy was smaller. It was newer. We raised less money. But I don't think there was a difference in wealth. I think it was a difference in just how people perceived of giving it away. I think that has certainly evolved in the last 30, 40 years, but it felt sometimes like we were asking people for the first time.
Interesting. So when you talk about a culture of philanthropy, you really feel that at a maybe place like Lawrenceville at the time relative to Kate, and where it's, you know, maybe more of a novel concept versus almost an expectation.
And I think some of that is also sort of that transition from alumni giving to more parent giving. Parent giving was small at all schools back then. It has certainly grown. And I think as alumni of West Coast schools have begun to sort of mature in their thinking about supporting those organizations, alumni giving has grown commensurately at a lot of West Coast schools where 40 years ago, it was still sort of a novel thing.
Ocean aside from the Mesa, you felt compelled to move back to the Northeast. Not an easy move, let's be honest. Not a lot of people saying, you know, from Southern California, I should go to Boston. Or specifically,
what most people said to me was, wait a minute, you live in Santa Barbara and you have a job and you're willing to give that up to go to Boston. So made the move, Boston. There were some political reasons that it was a good time to sort of think about a new opportunity. I had an opportunity to go to Middlesex School in Boston and Concord to run their advancement team. And what made it really compelling to me was the thought that the biggest campaign that Middlesex had ever had prior to my arrival was $9 million. and I think my memory serves that they missed the goal. They fell short of a $9 million goal. But the capacity of the place was extraordinary. The amount of resources that had been a part of the school, the wealth of some of the alumni who I knew of, the wealth of some of the families whose children were at the school, just felt to me like an extraordinary opportunity to really make a mark on institution in sort of helping to sort of change the trajectory of their philanthropy.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing place. It really feels like just a liberal arts college campus if you haven't been there. And, you know, tell me about just, I mean, what struck me when we met is maybe similar to your experience at Lawrenceville is you really have been a road warrior. I mean, you know, there were obviously you're on campus. And as you're saying, there's great connectivity when the development, I mean, you're walking by students every day, you're at games, you're seeing families, but you're also on the road a lot. And it also struck me that you love that work. Like you loved, you were unfazed by getting on the plane, you know, one hotel to another, you know, many nights on the road. Not only were you not unfazed by it, it's like if you weren't doing that, you'd kind of get antsy. Like I need to get back out there. And is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I think it really is. I mean, I don't know that I ever loved the flights and the sleeping in the hotel, but it really is sort of when it really sort of hit home that you just don't raise very much money if you're sitting at your desk. And in a place like Middlesex, where our alumni and parents lived all over the country, all over the world, if you want to be really good at this job, you've got to meet people where they are. And even fast forward today, Zoom is great for podcasts and for committee meetings. And it's really kind of crappy for deep personal engagement. And so being on the road and meeting people on their turf and having them share with you their home or their office or their artwork or their garage full of cars or whatever it is, it builds that relationship. It builds that sort of bond with you and more importantly with the institution, and also gives you such great intel on what people care about, what people prioritize, what the wealth that might be part of their overall sort of capacity. And so I loved being that, loved doing that, loved sort of being in a place that I'd never been before, loved being back at a place that I loved. 1995, I think, 1994, 95, we were maybe the first or one of the very first independent schools to really start looking at Asian philanthropy, started making annual or twice a year trips to Asia. The first time we went, I think we hit 7 or 8 or 9 countries in 2 weeks. But again, building those relationships and, you know, sort of the truism in fundraising, the further you're traveling, the more likely people are to say yes to an appointment. And so every single person we tried to see in Seoul was happy to see us.
So is that it's distance makes the heart grow fonder? Is that the reality?
I think that's true. It's really hard when you're in Concord, Massachusetts, to set up a meeting in Lexington, Massachusetts, or even in Boston. But San Francisco, easier, and Hong Kong, easiest.
Jim, I know the answer to this question because it's one of my all-time favorite questions that I've ever asked anyone, or the responses anyway, but I have to do it. Have you ever asked anyone for too much money, Jim? Have you ever asked anyone for too much money?
So several times, but my favorite ask for too much money story, one of my great mentors at Middlesex was a former board chair named Tom Bancroft. And Tom was old school, a gentleman's gentleman, a little on the New England tight side of things. Tom's golf shoes were held together with duct tape. He drove an old Buick, but lived in a grand home on Long Island's North Shore. Tom would do anything for his school. And so we were in a campaign, and Tom and I flew to Los Angeles to solicit a longtime board member alum named Wally. And Wally was probably 80 at the time, or close to it. And Wally had been very generous to Middlesex throughout his life. And we were in the early stages of this campaign. It was a $125 million campaign. And so we met with Wally at Ivy at the Shore in Santa Monica. And we had a nice conversation. Wally and Tom were contemporaries. And it came down to the moment. And we said, well, Wally, we really, you know, in acknowledgement of your family and your great ties to school and how important this is to you, we hope that you'll join us with a gift of $1 million. And there's noise all around us, but our table went dead silent. Wally's face went from Southern California tan to ashen white. He reached over, got his wine glass, and chugged the glass of wine, motioned for the waiter to fill his glass of wine, drank the second glass of wine, and then stammered I can't do that. There was a longer version of that. And we recovered and we finished our lunch and we moved on. Wally ended up giving probably $600,000 or $700,000 to that campaign. Tom and I thought we had killed him. And he wanted to do his best for his school. And as I say, he came close to that over the course of the campaign, but he was not expecting the $1 million ask to come his way that day.
Thank you for sharing. And so what is the lesson learned, Jim? Would you do anything different, or is it just part of the job? Like, it is going to happen and you've got to be confident in the mission that you're selling and recognize that, you know, there is no perfect science to what gift you anchor with. I mean, any lesson learned, or it's just inevitable when you do it that many times?
I think for me, a little bit of the lesson learned is we weren't that far off with our ask. He wanted to do something like that, felt like he couldn't. Little dog barking there.
This is a very pet friendly podcast, so good. Feel free. Yeah. Let us see.
You know, I think some of it was that, you know, at the time, this is probably in 2000 or 1999. We didn't have any research really at all. We didn't have the kind of wealth screening availability. We knew that Wally had been generous. We knew that he owned a company. We knew that he lived in a really nice house. And it felt like $1 million felt like a good number. Would we have asked for a different number if we knew more, if we had more intelligence, if we had better wealth screening? Maybe we would have asked him for more. I don't know. As a consultant, I want my clients to have sort of a 60 or 70% yield rate on their ask. If you're asking for $1 million and you get $1 million, you probably didn't ask for enough. If you're asking for $1 million and get 400,000, you probably either didn't make your case or you asked too much. And we got a yield of about 60 or 70% with Wally. And so, that feels to me about right. I'm glad we didn't kill him, but it was probably the right ask. It was aspirational for him.
Have you seen it go the other way, either in your direct work or with consultants, where the ask is made and somebody says, actually, I have bigger aspirations or I have bigger dreams? Do people sort of upgrade themselves, if you will, or pretty uncommon?
I have several personal experiences where that was the case. I made a decision here at Branson last year. We had decided we were going to ask a family to support the school with a $50,000 annual fund gift. So we met with them. I had a different impression of who these people were before the meeting than during the meeting. I was getting a vibe from them that 50 was maybe going to be more than they would give to the annual fund. And so we pivoted mid conversation and asked them for 25. And they said, well, we were thinking about giving $75,000 to the annual fund. So it happens. I would say that it's rare. In my experience, both as a consultant and as a practitioner, if you ask for less than the family was thinking about giving, they're probably going to give you what you asked for.
And it sounds like when you talk about the yield that you would aspire for, 60-70%, that putting a finer point on it, there's a lot more risk in asking for too little versus too much. And there must be scenarios where the yield has been zero, right? Where there was an ask and it just was not the right fit. But in the grand scheme of things, that's probably better than not asking at all. And so how do you navigate the polite decline, if you will, or maybe a impolite decline from time to time? Any advice, or, you know, some of it is probably just building a thick skin, but what else?
Yeah. I mean, I think if we do our jobs well, we're going to minimize the number of times that we get the response that's just wildly different than what we're hoping for. I always say people shouldn't be surprised with the number that you put in front of them, but sometimes you just don't have the ability to engage with that donor enough to prepare, or you really are hoping somebody's going to play a leadership role in your campaign. They've given the sort of the vibe and the response that they're on board with you. You know what they've given to other organizations, and you find out at the time of the ask, or at the time of the ask, that you're not their priority. or you get the preemptive strike, the preemptive gift, as you're going to the ask, hoping to ask for $2 million. And the donor says, we really are pleased to give you $100,000 before you even had a chance to ask.
I don't know if I've heard the expression preemptive gift before. I like
The preemptive strike.
Is that a donor strategy where like savvy donors know I'm going to tell you what I'm giving before you can ask me?
I would be surprised if that's a novel term to anyone else who's listening to this podcast. I think sometimes it is intentional. I think sometimes prior to a meeting or in the course of the conversation, a donor says, you know, this organization thinks that I'm a priority. They're not my priority. I want to make it clear from the outset that I see myself at this number. I do think that there are opportunities to go back to donors. I think sometimes there's not an understanding of what we are hoping the donor might do. I've certainly gone back to a handful of donors and said, you are such a visible, important member of this community. People look to you for leadership. And if that's your gift, other people are going to set their own giving in relationship to what you have done. And is there a way, could you do this gift for the next 3 years? Could you make this a longer term commitment? Can we come back to you later in the campaign to talk to you about a different kind of a gift? But sometimes you have to say, thank you for your $100,000 and move on to the next best opportunity.
When I got to know you, Jim, I didn't know very much about the independent school world at all, right? I'd gone to Brown, but growing up in Iowa, there just wasn't much exposure to the independent school or boarding school world. If anything, I thought boarding school is where you went when you got in trouble. Getting to know you and really getting a window into your network and just the connectivity. I mean, people talk about how this is a fun industry to work in because people are very collaborative, but there is a level of friendship among many of the leading boarding school or independent school fundraising professionals that is, in all of my experiences, really something unique. Like, lots of different conferences get together, peer groups get together, but you all really had an amazing group. Maybe it's still like that. I'm not as in the know today, but just tell me a little bit about kind of that, either independent school, you know, the ISL, the Cypress group that you all had. I don't know if we're allowed to talk about that, but yeah, you know what I mean? The connected
group. No, I think there really is a camaraderie among folks in independent schools. There is a little more sort of porous fluidity. Did I make up a scientific term there?
Sounded amazing, and everyone here is going to start using it. So continue.
Great. Well, the porous fluidity of people from higher ed sort of coming into schools, a little bit less going the other way, but I think that camaraderie has been true. There was a moment, 20 years ago, Bev Coughlin, who's been at Belmont Hill School in Boston forever, longtime friend, mentor, consulting colleague of mine, we were asked to convene a group of sort of leaders in independent school advancement for a leadership summit prior to a CASE NAS conference that was in San Diego, years before I lived in San Diego. And so we assembled a group that included Taylor Stockdale from Webb and a couple of others. And so we were together sort of as a teaching faculty, and we realized that there was such a great sort of spirit and camaraderie among us that we wanted to create something that was a little bigger than that. We created a group that eventually became the Cypress Group. It never grew to be more than 20 people. It was intended to just be a small fraternal opportunity for people from schools that were very successful in fundraising, that had a really sort of forward-thinking visionary development director, and who was sort of fun to be with. And for the last 20 years, that group has gotten together once a year. We have a lot of fun. We drink some decent wine, but really it's about sort of sharing ideas and sharing data. And other organizations have begun to sort of come somewhat close to what we have done, but we share the kind of data, the detail, the sort of in the weeds data about trustee giving and advancement services, salaries, and ninth grade parent participation, and every possible, you know, sort of 100 pages of data, and that ability to share that data. There's no overlap really in this group. We don't share common constituents, and so being able to have access to that kind of data has been it's been really sort of game changing for a lot of us.
Probably reasonable level of group therapy as well. I mean, just having people that have had to navigate the same issues or similar stresses or drama or, you know, tragedies or whatever the things are that come and go as part of life. It really was an amazing group to get a window into.
Yeah, it was great. So it's a good group. We still get together and couple of us are still in from the very beginning. Been some great changes too as well.
So let's bring it home. Tell me about life at Branson today. Also doing some consulting work as well. What are you excited about now? What are you focused on? And how can folks kind of stay in touch with you after this?
Great. I had sort of finished up my development career, spent a couple of years at Evertrue, helped that your great company sort of find its footing, and then became a consultant and joined Martz & Lundy. I had been a Martz & Lundy client. Michael Sinkus from Martz & Lundy was my consultant for probably a decade and a half. And really felt that consulting and working with schools was going to be a great way to sort of finish out my career. Did that full time for 5 or 6 years. And Branson, which is this extraordinary school in Marin County, north of San Francisco, a little bit like my Middlesex experience, the capacity was unfathomable in terms of who had gone to the school, who had been a parent at the school or was, and a culture of philanthropy had been sort of hampered by some leadership challenges the school had had over the years, a failed plan or thought about selling a campus and moving. And so there for 15 years, there had been no campaign. Branson was a client, and I really value and respect the head of school, Chris Mazzola. You're not allowed to have favorite clients, but Chris was you know, certainly one of my favorite clients. The pandemic sort of crippled their internal capacity, and they made some decisions to change leadership. I at first was being a good consultant and trying to help them sort of bridge a gap. Chris is a very convincing leader and convinced me to come back into a school. And my condition on coming in was that I wanted to continue to consult on an active basis. And so I am full time at Branson, but I still carry a load of six or seven clients at a time. And I love that. I love that balance. I love sort of being down in the weeds, figuring out sort of strategy for a major gift solicitation or sort of moving the needle with the annual fund or hiring a team. But then I also love being able to sort of think differently with another organization and then bring some of that back to Branson. We've just launched what for this school is a pretty extraordinary campaign. Our goal now is 85 million. Working goal, we may move that to 100. We just got the first two $5 million gifts in the school's history. So we're working to shift that. It's not going to be an easy run. We have not engaged our alumni, very typical of a West Coast school. And so we have alums with sort of huge, huge capacity who've never really been asked to do anything. And so we're going to see what kind of good work we can do. We've partnered with Evertrue. We may be your smallest client, but I think our ability to benefit from the kind of data that we have not had previously is going to be really important for us.
Well, it's interesting. You said in our pre-podcast questionnaire, you know, what do you think will or should be the next step forward for the advancement industry? You said more and more personalization. I couldn't agree more. And I don't think it matters if you are TCU or Michigan or Ohio State or the Branson School. The way that we are going to cut through the noise in 2023 and 2024 and beyond is by personalization, is by authenticity. And some of that will come in the form of work that is not that different than hitting the road to Natchez, Mississippi. And some of it's going to be a lot different because technology is evolving so quickly, and the ability to track data and act upon it is improving, right? And like some of the problems we're trying to solve today, I feel like they're the same problems when we first met. We have made amazing strides. Like truly, when I think about walking into your office, not just us, but like collectively as an industry, we have made amazing strides. But it feels like in the not too distant future, there should be sort of step function level ways to improve so that, small institutions like Branson or very large institutions can deliver more and more personalization because there's such an advantage, you know, the same reason that those lawyers would give you those meetings in Shreveport. Education changes lives. It creates mentorship and supports big dreams and college access. And there aren't a lot of brands that our constituents work with or transact with that they have that sort of mutual kind of relationship with. And that's, what inspired us to go down this path. And it's what gets me fired up to this day and seeing folks like you, you know, convert relationships into philanthropy is just, it's amazing.
Yep. Now it's a really rewarding opportunity. And I think the more we can sort of create and work with technologies like Evertrue and some others that we use to just give us more time to be face to face with potential donors, I think is what's going to allow a lot of that change to continue. Yeah.
Less time digging through manila folders, more time talking to humans, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
I love it, Jim. Hey, so are you hiring? If folks want to stay in touch, I know you're active on LinkedIn. Is that the best way?
Yeah, LinkedIn is great. We are hiring. I thought I had my dream team, but Stanford Athletics poached a great campaign major gift officer. So got an opening, a small team of 9 or 10, but nimble. And so we're looking for somebody good. So.
Well, Jim, thanks so much for joining us today, for all of the support over the years, for sharing your story. Wish you the absolute best and look forward to staying in touch.
Right. Thanks, Brent. Good to see you again.
Thanks, Jim, and take care, everybody.